Hi, everyone. We're going to go ahead and begin today. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for Denton's Perspectives, where Denton senior advisors share their unique perspective on the policy and political developments shaping and dominating the news today. Today, we're very honored to be joined by former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, to discuss President-elect Donald Trump's surprise victory Tuesday and the transition to the next administration. My name is James Richardson, and together he and I are members of Denton's Public Policy and Regulation Practice. This program series, like all those before it, may be considered on the record. A recording of it will be made available later today on our website, www.dentons.com, where you can also find a special 51-page report in which our team dissects the mechanics of Mr. Trump's stunning victory and the major policy initiatives that will shape his administration and the next Congress. So with that, let's begin. Speaker Gingrich, Donald Trump's victory Tuesday over Hillary Clinton defied all electoral modeling and conventional wisdom, except perhaps yours. What do you make of why the polls were so incorrect? And more to the point, how did Trump actually engineer this victory?
Well, I would say a couple things. First, that all of our listeners should go to FoxNews.com on Monday. Pat Caddell, who used to be Jimmy Carter's pollster, wrote a very insightful analysis. They could also go to GingrichProductions.com, where I do a newsletter, and the one which just came out is Why Was the Establishment So Wrong, and it includes part of Caddell's article in there. And the other person who really got it right was Matt Cowley, who has been a pollster and close friend of mine for 30 years, and his explanation is pretty straightforward. All of the elite media pollsters, all the people in the establishment, made several assumptions that turned out not to be true. One of them was that you would have an African-American turnout comparable to what you saw in with Obama in 2008 and 2012. In fact, you got a substantially lower turnout, and that had a particularly negative effect on Hillary because she was counting on that vote for 90 or 93% of that vote to be for her. Second, a lot of the national data you're seeing is misleading because it includes California, which is our largest state. In California, we did not contest California. So the Democrats had an unusually large majority in California, and that then drew a lot of numbers in a direction that wasn't an accurate reflection. Third, the states that were the most traditional but had historically been blue-collar Democrats, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, the blue-collar Democrats had all become extraordinarily alienated from Obama and from Clinton. So what you were getting was a lower turnout in the big cities, Philadelphia, Detroit, Milwaukee, while you were getting very much higher turnouts in rural America. And so, in effect, as you watch the evening progress, rural America was beating urban America, and that gave Trump three big states in the Midwest to people. And, you know, people really thought you couldn't get to Pennsylvania, you certainly couldn't get Michigan, and that he would never get Wisconsin. Well, he got all three, and I'm going to get all three. But in the process, Senator Toomey was reelected in Pennsylvania. Senator Johnson, who had run a very, very aggressive race, was reelected in Wisconsin. And so the result you had was a substantial party victory. The Republican Party today is probably the strongest it's ever been. They have the most governors we've ever had, unless you count Reconstruction, where they weren't really elected. So they're the most governors we've ever had. They're the most state legislators we've ever had. We just picked up the Kentucky House, which we haven't had since 1920. We picked up the Iowa State Senate. We retained control of the U.S. Senate in a year where the numbers were very much against us. There were 24 Republican senators and 10 Democrats. And despite that, we were able to keep control of the Senate. And our House majority was almost unchanged. I think it's down 7 or something like that. So it's a remarkable year. And Trump turned out in the end to be a very effective polarizing candidate and gave people a choice, as he would have described it, between corruption and change, and they picked change. And in fact, interestingly, one of the most interesting questions that was asked was, do you think that both of these candidates are unfit to be president. People who answered yes to both of them being unfit picked Trump by like 70-30 or more. They asked another question about, do you think that they have the temperament to be president? And among those who said neither of them had the right temperament, again, Trump was picking it up by 70-30 or more. So he had figured out very early on that there was a large base of popular hostility to Washington. Drain the swamp became an effective slogan for that. But he grew increasingly aware the more he campaigned. And in many ways, he used his rallies as giant focus groups because he listened very carefully to what people responded to and what got them excited. And the result was he got bolder and bolder and bolder and ultimately had a very profound reform package, which he unveiled at Gettysburg. And probably the most important Trump speech of the year is the speech he gave at Gettysburg, where he outlined a contract with the American voter, which is quite detailed and quite a dramatic reformism. And then the second thing he did, I think, that fits this, is he offered about 3 or 4 days later in Charlotte and a new deal for African Americans. And both of those were very policy-oriented and reflected a growing boldness on his part that he thought that there was a majority of the country prepared to really dramatically change Washington. As a result, he's now the president-elect, and as we're, you know, he spent part of his morning meeting with President Obama in the White House. He's currently at lunch with Majority Leader McConnell and with Speaker Ryan and with Vice President-elect Pence, and they are reflecting on the fact that, you know, this whole thing worked, everybody's amazement, and they are now the governing team in Washington. First time since 1952 that all three levels of authority, House, Senate, and White House, are in Republican hands.
You touched on this, but I'd like to drill down a little deeper on it, on the inability of pollsters to locate and track the media is calling the invisible Trump voter. We saw that in the course of the very long Republican primaries and again in the general election. And it's very reminiscent, in my view, of pollsters' inability to find the invisible Brexit voters. So what is it about these populist campaigns here and abroad that so defies political science, conventional wisdom, and polling?
I think it's two very different things. I think first, there is the reality that the models the pollsters themselves had, and this happened on Election Day, where I was frankly very confused because the exit polling sounded much worse than reality, and Max Howery intervened and pointed out to me they are adjusting the polls based on the same models that have been wrong all year. And, of course, that became obvious in 4 or 5 hours. But in that setting, the first thing you have to understand is these guys all have models that they rely on, and if the model is wrong, everything else is going to be wrong. The second difference is that the conservative nationalist voter is so vilified by the elite media, whether it's in Britain or France or Germany or the United States, they are so attacked and so disparaged. You know, they're xenophobic, they're isolationist, they're racist. I mean, just think about the mean, nasty names. First of all, they're distinguished by the fact that they're against the establishment to start with, and then when you start calling them names, they just buckle down and they ignore the establishment totally. And so a lot of them, you know, one of the points that was made about exit polling, I was talking to Ben Dumman, she does a wonderful newsletter called The Transit. And Dumman was on, I think, on PBS talking about all this on election night, and he said they began to come in and warn that there was a significant block of people who would not talk to the pollsters when they left the voting booth, and that these people were almost all Trump supporters. And I think this goes back to the depth of hostility between the elite media and the anti-establishment conservatives, who increasingly see themselves alienated from and in a way, scorned and ridiculed by an elite media that they refuse to cooperate with.
You mentioned that President-elect Trump and Vice President-elect Pence are meeting today with congressional leadership. What do you expect to be the policy priorities of Trump's administration and the new Congress? And
Do you think that there will be any conflict between the two branches?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of natural conflict, because there always is. That's the nature of the American constitutional system. But I will say that Paul Ryan's comments yesterday in Gainesville, his hometown in Wisconsin, were superb. They were exactly on market, well worth people going and looking at. You know, I mean, he said, look, what Donald Trump has done is unimaginable. To come out of nowhere, to never have run for office at any level, to win the presidency first by the hostile takeover of your own party, where basically you had a grassroots rebellion against the Washington establishment. There were 15 other very fine candidates, and you ran over all of them with the help of the American people. Then to pivot and take on somebody who represented a machine that raised $1 billion, had the full backing of the President of the United States, had the full backing of the elite news media, and then beat her. Well, these are extraordinary achievements. And Paul Ryan was very generous yesterday in saying that clearly Donald Trump is now the leader of the United States and is the leader of the Republican Party and the Speaker of the House. I'm going to work with him. So I think it's very significant. Trump fully understands that if McConnell doesn't help him, he cannot get his cabinet through the Senate. So he really needs McConnell. He also understands that if Ryan refuses to schedule it, he won't get any of his legislative programs through the House. So there's a natural, exactly as the Founding Fathers designed it, there's a natural symbiotic relationship between the House, the Senate, and the President. That's why they're meeting today. I think it's a very important step in the right direction. Trump is going to have a very aggressive agenda in January, and they're going to work very hard, as Paul Ryan said. They want to be so lined up and so prepared that the day he is sworn in, he can hit the ground running, starting with repealing Obama's executive orders and then moving to passing major legislation. So I think you will see a very focused, practiced effort here that could, in fact, lead to a remarkably exciting opening 6 months.
Speaker Ryan famously kept Mr. Trump at arm's length during the general election, at times even condemning him. But on Wednesday, as you said, in Janesville, he explicitly embraced the president-elect. Republicans clearly have the numbers to select the next Speaker of the House, but do you believe Mr. Ryan does in Trump's new Washington? What sort of longevity does he have in the speakership? Is that imperiled by the distance he put between the president-elect and himself during the general?
No, I think, in fact, that by the end of the campaign, they've gotten along pretty well. And I think that Ryan himself said that Trump actually helped elect a number of Republicans because he turned out he did have coattails. I think at the same time, Trump understands that having, you know, Ryan's one of the smartest policy people in the United States. And so to have Ryan as an active ally is greatly to Trump's advantage, yet Trump wants to really profoundly change what's going on. And I think that the odds are very high that they're going to find ways to work together rather than find ways to fight. And I think that's very, very good for America.
As you mentioned, Republicans have for years attempted to repeal the president's singular achievement in health care. And now they finally have the vehicle to do it with both the executive and legislative branches. But what is it that they're going to put forward to take its place? Has Trump actually put forward a cohesive health care plan yet?
Well, Ryan just released a 20-page outline of a replacement model that I suspect will be the first starting point to discuss this. And I think over the next 6 or 7 weeks, you're going to see a lot of very intense effort on health, rethinking the health system. But let me also point out that in the middle of all this, they have a lame duck session. And some of the discussions they've got to have are very practical. Do they want, you know, does Trump want a continuing resolution that goes all the way to next October 1st, or does he want a short one that goes, say, to April 1st so he can reshape the rest of the federal budget? That's a very big decision. And there are a number of those kind of decisions they have to make about what they will and won't do in the lame duck session that are also going to be part of today's meeting.
Republicans are obviously very eager to undo the Affordable Care Act and the president's other major accomplishments. But do you think that there's a risk in them rushing to the legislative table to undo these almost overnight with what is seemingly no plan to replace them outside of health care?
Well, look, let me just say that I think people have been talking about this stuff for 4 or 5 years now. So it's not like they're suddenly discovering this. So I think you will see serious, thoughtful plans. And then, again, I think it's pretty hard to argue that Paul Ryan isn't pretty prepared. Fred Upton is pretty prepared. I mean, they've got a number of people. Lamar Alexander on the Senate side is very prepared. You know, these guys weren't sitting around waiting for the election. They've been holding hearings and consulting experts and talking about how to do this for a long time.
So if Trump does honor his campaign promises, including health care, the nation stands on the brink of what would be a dramatic shift in domestic and foreign policy. What is it that you think Trump will actually – what promises do you think he'll make good on first? And you know, I'm interested in sort of the mechanics of building a wall and forcing another nation to finance it now that he's president or soon to be.
Well, okay. I mean, you jumped to one particular thing, but let me point out that the easy first big thing he can do is send up a conservative to be the Supreme Court justice. I mean, just that one step will draw very, very sharply the difference between Donald J. Trump and Hillary Clinton. And I think that's easy, and it's going to happen either in late January or early February. Second, he is going to have a wave of repealing Obama's executive orders, and that will reshape the federal government in the first 48 or 72 hours in a very dramatic way. Third, and I've always been surprised at this conversation, this is a man who made $10 billion in part by building things. I mean, he knows how to build big buildings. He knows how to build golf courses. He knows how to build lots of stuff. The idea that Trump can't figure out how to control the southern border is just silly. Now, that doesn't mean it's all going to be a wall like the, you know, like the Great Wall of China. But I believe there's a reason that both the Border Patrol and the people who work for ICE both endorsed him. And I think that they genuinely believe that he is going to be a president who gives them the ability to get to control of the southern border, which is not technically a hard problem. It just takes resources and focus. Hungary reduced refugee flow into the country by 99% in one day by just being practical. So a lot of this is just sort of elite media baloney. If you want to control the border, you can. If you want to figure out a way to pose an entrance fee until you finish paying off the border, you could do that. Or you could have a fee for the repatriation of money back to Mexico. There are lots of ways to get around all that. Whether or not Trump will actually spend much time on that, I'm not sure. He'll spend a lot of time controlling the border. He may not spend very much time trying to get Mexico to pay for it, but it was a great campaign device.
Secretary Clinton had what amounts to a massive transition team and was reportedly ready to name a White House Chief of Staff, Mr. Trump. However, his team is rather skeletal. So how does the president-elect go about the enormous task of filling the nearly 4,000 appointments with qualified candidates in the next 3 months before he takes office?
Now, let me point out that Secretary Clinton spent twice as much money as Donald Trump and lost the presidency. He literally outspent him 2-1 and lost the presidency. She does things big. She raised $1 billion. She had a big bureaucracy. He had a very small, lean operation, which was partnered with the Republican National Committee. The Republican National Committee had hired 7,500 field staff and was the biggest it had ever been in history. And people did not realize the key role the chairman elect's previous played. So you had the Republican National Committee providing a ground game, while you had the Trump campaign providing the air game and the social media game. And that was the combination that beat the billion-dollar campaign. Trump runs a lot of things. He runs, I think, 18 golf courses. He runs hotels. He runs commercial buildings. He has properties in the Middle East. He has properties in Scotland. He has properties in Panama. I think he will very rapidly staff up. But he makes very fast decisions. He knows a lot of people. And it's pretty clear that Rudy Giuliani will get a major job. It's pretty clear that Senator Jeff Sessions will get a major job. And then he'll delegate to those guys to say, fill out your department. I mean, I think he will be a very, very good manager, and that's one of the things we haven't seen much of, since General Eisenhower became president.
Hillary Clinton's running mate, Tim Kaine, is going to return to Washington as a U.S. Senator from Virginia with at least another 2 years left in office before he faces reelection. Do you expect Senator Kaine to reach for the mantle of the anti-Trump in the Senate, or is that void going to be filled by Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or someone who's yet to step up?
I don't know. I mean, my sense is that Tim Kaine is not naturally the leader of the opposition, that he's a much more positive person in that he wants to focus on real issues. And, that doesn't mean he won't oppose Trump and vote against Trump's Supreme Court nominee or something like that. But I don't see him trying to carve out a position. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is a much more natural leader of the opposition. And the other thing to remember, of course, is that Chuck Schumer, who's known Trump for many, many years, and he's a New York senator, is going to be the leader of the Senate Democrats. And I think Schumer and Trump get along personally very well, and I think that they will do a lot of business together.
You mentioned Rudy Giuliani being named in a possible senior position in the cabinet. You yourself have been named in various media reports as a shortlist candidate for White House Chief of Staff, Secretary of State. I'm interested what you make of all this intense speculation about your future and what role, if any, you'd like to play in Trump's administration.
Well, I've been around a long time. I helped in 1980 with Reagan's election. I helped in 1994 with the Contract of America and the first Republican House majority in 40 years. I was Speaker for 4 years. So if you just look at the totality of my career, and I've been very active speaking and campaigning for Trump, so it's natural for people to turn and say, gee, what's Nick going to do? My goal is to be the senior planner looking at the totality of the federal government and thinking through how to redesign it. And to do that really as an outsider, because I think it's virtually impossible to be in the government and maintain the strategic focus you need if you want very, very large-scale change. So that's what I hope I'll be able to work out.
I'd like to close the call today by asking whether or not you believe that this coalition Trump has built is a sustainable one for the Republican Party and whether or not it will carry them through in the midterms to follow.
Well, the core model of the coalition has been tried out at the state level, where we now have 34 governors and we have a huge number of state legislatures. If Trump comes in and gets the economy growing, if he, in fact, passes some substantial reforms, if he gains control of the southern border, if people feel that if he really does develop a new deal with African Americans in the inner city, he could actually grow a very big Republican majority. But to do that, he's going to have to remain focused on big things and not let Washington nibble him to death with small things. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Right. Thank you so much, Speaker Gingrich, for your time and insight today. I speak for all my colleagues and our clients when I say how very fortunate we are to have you on our team to share your insight and expertise. Again, a recording of this program will be made available this afternoon on our website, www.dentons.com. Thank you and have a good day.